Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. This week, we've spent 2 days in Adelaide to bring you some interviews on the South Australian election, which is held on March 17, and where the Labor government is seeking a fifth term. If Labor wins, by the end of that term, it would have been in office for 2 decades. But perhaps the most interesting aspect of this campaign is the challenge of the Nick Xenophon party called SA Best, which is aiming to get the balance of power and to call the shots post-election. Xenophon, who proved himself a vote-winning machine in his Senate career, resigned from federal parliament last year for his tilt at state politics, where he started out his political life. His entry into this contest has made the result highly unpredictable, and the campaign itself another case study of the protest vote in modern politics. In this podcast, we talk with two academic experts, Dean Jentsch, Emeritus Professor from Flinders University, and Carol Johnson, Professor of Politics at the University of Adelaide. We also speak with Premier Jay Weatherill and with Nick Xenophon. Opposition leader Stephen Marshall could not fit us into his schedule, but South Australian Federal Cabinet Minister Christopher Pyne provided his insights into the campaign. We start with Dean Jentsch and with some of the peculiarities of the South Australian electoral system. Dean Jentsch, you've been observing elections since 1968, a very long time. What's special about this one in South Australia?
Well, the thing that's really special is it's the first time in South Australia's history we have a real three-party contest. Normally it's been Labor versus Liberal, with a sprinkling of minor parties, but this time it's a three-party contest and it's incredibly complex.
Well, the South Australian electoral system does appear to have operated very oddly over the years, with governments often elected on a minority of the two-party vote. Has this been a gerrymander, or has it simply been some peculiarity in the distribution of voters?
It's been the opposite of a gerrymander, because we got rid of it. The Parliament passed an act some time ago called the Fairness Clause, and that built in a system where the Electoral Commission has to redistribute after every election on the basis that it will produce an election, produce a result where the any party which receives more than 50% of the two-party preferred vote will win government. It has only succeeded in doing that, to my knowledge, twice. In the main, it's been out of kilter with the result because it's based on an essential flaw. It makes the assumption that everyone is going to vote the same way in the next election as they did in the last. And as a result, we've had elections where 53% of the two-party preferred vote has not meant winning government.
And of course, this government, this Labor government, only won a minority of the two-party vote.
47% at the last election.
Which is extraordinary. If you think nationally, that's inconceivable that you could get that sort of result and the government survive. You might get 49 point something, but 47?
Well, it's conceivable if you take into account the convoluted system of trying to get a fair result. This time, the Electoral Commission has come up with a redistribution which is much more representative of the patterns of voting at the last election. And I think it will probably have the chance of being one of the very few that produces a result where the proportion of votes is equivalent to the proportion of seats.
Well, you mentioned before that this is a genuinely three-horse race. Does that affect the likelihood of the result being representative of community opinion? And what do you think the Xenophon factor is going to do in this election?
Well, let's take that first question. It's unlikely to represent the majority opinion of the people because it's going to be an election based emphatically on preferences. None of the three parties is going to win a majority of first preference votes, either in many of the seats or overall. So it's going to be an election which is essentially on the preferences. Now, that's
really who people dislike least.
Well,
sort of.
To some degree, yes. But they are required to put their first, second, third and fourth and subsequent preferences. And given the fact that we have an electorate which, in terms of the polls, is showing about a third, a third, a third across those three parties, then there's no way it's going to represent, because it can't finish up with three parties in the parliament. Well, it can, but I think it's unlikely.
This is almost likely to be a random result in a way, because you could have a few hundred votes in a number of electorates determining the result, couldn't you?
Oh, yes, you can. And that's not unusual in Australian politics, where you have a preferential system. And it's, again, not unusual even in proportional representational systems.
But when you've got a three-way contest with the parties virtually equal, if that's how it ended up, then it almost becomes random.
Well, it could become random in terms of who's going to actually form government. But the big question is just how those preferences will go. I think that's the issue that's making me feel that I haven't got the faintest idea who's going to win this election. Nick Xenophon is promising to have an open ballot paper and leaving the preferences to the voters. I don't know whether that's going to make it more complex. I suspect it is.
So when I ask how the Xenophon factor is going to work out, no one knows at this point. Is that the answer?
Nobody really knows, except that a week ago I was quite confident that Xenophon would even have an opportunity of being in a position where, if he wasn't deciding who was the government, to have a major role in choosing who was the government. Since then, his support has diminished. It's gone from approximately 32% down to about 21%. Now, if that continues, then his effect is going to be minimal. But if it stays at 21, it's still a very powerful force in an electoral system like this.
And of course, you can have the situation where that sort of vote could either deliver him a lot of seats, depending on whether he got number two in particular seats and then got up through preferences, or it could deliver him none if he didn't get quite to number two.
Well, this is the key point. If he runs second, then I think there is a high likelihood that Nick Xenophon could win a handful of seats. I'm not going to give him 20 seats, but certainly a handful of
seats. Enough to have balance of power.
Enough to have the balance of power. But if he runs third, then it will be his preferences which will decide which out of Liberal or Labor will win. So it really does depend on the size of his support on election day. Well, even now, because we've got early polling going on. So it's going to be decided by where Xenophon fits up at the after the final count, whether he's second or third.
Well, now we've done our heads in with the complexities of this system and this situation, can I ask you more generally, why do you think South Australians have been so attracted to Xenophon? Even though his vote in the polling at the moment, the opinion polling has fallen somewhat, it's still very substantial.
Well, it is very substantial. But the point about Xenophon is that there is a certain amount of the Trump factor here. People in South Australia are very annoyed about the record of the Weatherill government. The state of South Australia, whether you look at education, water, electricity, the highest prices in Australia, if not the world, the nature of the economy, the problems of the changing of the structure of the production of electricity, nothing has been good news. It's all been relatively bad news, and I think people are looking for something different. Equally, however, the Liberal Party has not been upfront as much as I think it should have been. It hasn't made the impact up to this stage in this election campaign. So people are looking for an alternative. And Nick Xenophon, the master of stunts, as he's known, has kept his face and his policies before the public to a very high degree. They have moved to him because he's seen as an alternative to the other two parties with which they're not happy.
But it's interesting that he's representing a protest vote in the centre, where, for example, in Queensland, you might say that Hanson represented a protest vote to the right, and therefore it's a different phenomenon. It's more like the legacy of the old Australian Democrats, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's the Democrats writ large with some major differences. The differences being that this is a case of an absolutely dominant leader. It is Nick Xenophon's party, despite the fact that it's called SA Best. It's known as Mr. X's party in South Australia. But it really is holding an ideological position, if it's got any ideological position, equivalent to that of the Democrat. Nick Xenophon has not formulated absolutely clear policies on a range of key issues such as the economy and water and electricity because he is seeking votes from both sides of politics, from Labor and Liberal, something like the Democrats. But unlike the Democrats, Nick is not here to keep the bastards honest. Nick is here to be one of them.
Do you think that South Australians are less polarised than voters in some other states? How do they see themselves? Do they have a common identification as, in a way, the national underdogs, the state that misses out, that doesn't have the economic benefits, the natural resources and so on elsewhere?
We South Australians are just as polarised in a partisan sense as anywhere else in Australia. you could say perhaps 30% of South Australians are welded on Labor Party people. Equally, 30% are solidly, especially those in the rural areas, are solidly Liberal. The swinging people are there to about 30%, as is normal throughout Australia. So I don't think there's anything significantly different about our partisanship.
What issues, you've mentioned a few issues, but what issues do you think top two or three issues will really bite in this campaign?
Well, one that is biting is certainly the state of the economy. If you go back through the records of the last few weeks, you will find the word jobs mentioned. And all parties are trying to push hard to say that South Australia will get better jobs, more jobs than before. Equally, we're facing a question of electricity. The government here, Mr. Wetherill's government, is moving faster and further than anybody else in Australia, bringing in renewables, and that has caused some angst and some problems in the network. We have all three parties putting out their own policies on electricity. We have a problem of water, especially the price of water. We have problems with the general economy that I mentioned. We have problems with education, and we have major problems with social policies, especially around an aged care home, which over the last 12 months has been dominating the nature of the conversation in South Australia. It was found to be absolutely appalling in the way it was handling itself.
Do you think that the campaign itself is mattering, or do you think basically this election, even though we can't predict it, is sort of in the bag because people have made up their minds?
Well, the big question here is the Xenophon factor. If he's still
running,
can't
avoid him, can we?
We can't avoid him. if he's only running at 20, I mean, when I say only, that's compared to 32% of the vote a couple of weeks ago. Even if he's only running at 21%, then he becomes a key player. That's an indication that 21% of South Australians have openly rejected Labor and Liberal. But what they're going to do with their preferences is another matter. But I think it's, I've never seen anything like this. This isn't, it's an unpredictable election still with less than 2 weeks to go.
Do you think that Xenophon's presence will help or is likely to help Labor or the Liberal Party on balance?
On balance, I don't think it's going to help either of them. There is very complex series of discussions going on between Labor and Liberal and the Greens about what they can do about Xenophon, how they can handle Xenophon, what are they going to do with their preferences. There are rumours around that there's the possibility that Labor and Liberal might exchange preferences. Now, I'll wait to see if that happens. Although I suppose to a degree it's already in practice with the early voting. I also heard a story that the Greens are going to give their preferences to the Liberal Party in South Australia. I mean, this has become a complicated situation that is beyond belief for anybody who is used to the nature of Australian politics normally.
If he ends up with a balance of power, who do you think he'd prefer to govern with?
I don't. Again, I'm sorry to say this, but I haven't the faintest idea. He's given us no clue. He's been asked on numerous occasions that if it is a hung parliament, which party will you support? He's given no answer, and nobody has any idea which way he would go. I think it needs to be said, though, that Premier Wetherill is willing and able to go into coalition or agreement with anybody, which he's done on at least two occasions now. The Liberal leader, Mr. Marshall, has said that under no circumstances will he go into a coalition or an agreement with Nick Xenophon. So I think that just adds a little bit more complexity to it.
And looking at this from the Canberra angle, of course, I have to ask you, are the federal factors playing in at all to this campaign? It's a fairly wild scene there.
Well, it'd be hard to say that it wasn't playing a role because it's getting headline news over here as it is everywhere else in Australia. The Liberal Party would be not happy at all about the angst that's going on in the Liberal Party at the moment, about the inability of the Liberal Party to get up to a majority in the polls. Equally, Labor people, I think, are not absolutely pleased with Bill Shorten's style and his approach and some of his policies. But, yeah, I don't think you could have a state election without some impact from the federal scene. Equally, however, I doubt if the federal scene will look at South Australia and say, that's a clear message to us, because I don't know what the message will be.
Well, it sounds as though it's going to be a very complicated message. Dean Jens, thank you very much for talking with us. Jay Weatherall, to win this election, Labor actually needs to gain several seats on the redistribution and to have a swing towards it of about 3%, because you actually won last time with less than 50-50 two-party. This does seem a really hard ask, given that the ALP is seeking a fifth term, is seeking to be in for two decades. How much do you think the its time factor is going to count against you?
I suppose I prefer to see this as me asking for my second full term as Premier. But that there's no doubt that this is a challenge for our political party to paint a really bright picture of the future and show people how they fit into it. But every election is really a new contest. So really what goes before, to some degree, is a little irrelevant. I mean, this is a contest now between the players now and the objective circumstances that South Australia finds itself in now. So we're very much looking forward to telling that story and giving a good account of ourselves.
Jobs are a major issue in this contest. What are you offering to boost employment? Because jobs is always something that's difficult in this state.
It is. I mean, this is a central issue for us. It's my number one priority, and it has to be. I mean, at this point in our history with the loss of Holdens, we have to make this our priority, and we have over the last 4 years. So we stepped in to save the Wireless Steelworks, the Nearstar smelter up at Port Pirie. We were a massive proponent of the nation's largest defence procurement contract, which was the Future Submarines contract. And we've also been incredibly active attracting big international companies like Tesla and Boeing and Technicolor. And we're investing in, really for the future, the infrastructure that will continue to create those jobs. So we've got a $2 billion investment program, which covers a port, a new port for Spencer Gulf, upgrades of our level crossings, about seven of the most dangerous and congested crossings. We're also investing in a further upgrade of our tram network. And we're going to have a broadband, a fishbone network, which will provide ultra-high-speed broadband, which will support our businesses to grow. And then, of course, our leadership in renewable energy, which is creating extraordinary international attention and global leadership, which is bringing lots of opportunities here. One of the most spectacular examples is the German company Sonnen, which is going to make batteries for the first time in this part of the world to supply its Asia-Pacific operation.
Now, you mentioned the Whyalla Steelworks. What, if any, will be the effect of the American tariff increase to...
Zero. No, no
nothing
effect.
At all?
No.
Despite all these projects that you spoke about, do you think that young people growing up in South Australia still will be inclined to find the grass greener in the eastern states?
Well, there's always an extent to which that happens. I mean, small jurisdictions always have people looking to interstate or overseas for opportunities, and that's a good thing, and we don't want to discourage that, but we do want to provide the opportunities for people to find exciting jobs here at home. And, you know, those jobs that I was talking about before in Technicolor, I mean, this is basically people with artistic skills but also digital capability. 500 jobs Technicolor are bringing here. In Boeing, they're bringing 250 high-tech cybersecurity jobs into the CBD of Adelaide. Really highly technical but exciting jobs. And, you know, we're also seeing with Tesla the exciting new opportunities in building batteries and being part of that, the opportunities there. So a great job is necessary. It's not sufficient. You also need a great, exciting city. And that's why our small bars, our live music scene, you know, it's a really, this city is on the up. And there's every reason for young people to stay here.
Now, if I can turn to the energy issue.
Yeah.
Obviously, the storm in 2016, the subsequent power failure, has pushed your government into a great deal of action on a number of energy fronts. You've got your great big new battery operating. You've commissioned new power generation, backup generation. But what about prices? Consumers in this state pay very high prices for their power. Are they going to punish you?
Look, since July last year, the price differential between us and Victoria has closed down to just be relatively small, only a few dollars. And the national regulator, the AMEC, is saying that over the next 2 years it's going to fall by a further $300 on the average bill because of new generation. And so I think what people are seeing is we're stepping up and taking control of our energy future. So as well as the things that you've mentioned, there's the solar thermal plant, a new generator, which will bring capacity and competition into the market. And a world first, the world's largest a virtual power plant with 50,000 rooftop panels backed up by batteries, which we're going to start on our housing trust homes, which will bring a 30% reduction in power bills on those homes. So they can see things happening. They know that renewable energy means cheaper power. You take the sun and the wind, you store it, and then you play it out during peak times. People understand that will bring prices down.
Now, this election is a genuine three-horse race with Nick Xenophon's SA Best performing well in the polls, even though it's come off that very high peak. How much difference do you think that the Xenophon factor will make? And why are South Australians so attracted to middle ground protest parties? Because, after all, it was very much the home of the Australian Democrats some years ago.
Well, I might beg to differ in some respects. I think it's really, in essence, a two-horse race. You've got Nick Xenophon, who's a former member of the Liberal Party. He's recruited about eight...
Long time ago.
Well, yeah, but very recently he's recruited eight former Liberals to be part of his team. When he was in Canberra, he voted with the federal Liberal government on a very significant number of occasions, and most pointedly, he voted with them to support a $210 million cut to our education funding when he promised he wouldn't do that. So we see Nick Xenophon as another Liberal. We're fighting the Liberals itself. There's a further iteration of the Liberal Party with Corey Bernardi and his Conservatives. So there's the splintering of the Conservative vote. Labor is the only one that's offering a strong and stable, really offering about standing up for South Australia and putting our interests ahead of the powerful eastern states or other powerful corporate interests that always seem to govern the Conservative side of politics.
On balance, do you think that the Xenophon party will help Labor or help the Liberals more?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, he tends to be taking a larger proportion of his votes from the Liberal Party than the Labor Party, but how that plays out in individual seats is something that we'll have to see. But look, the critical issue at this election is, do you have somebody that's prepared to stand up for South Australia or somebody that's prepared to kowtow and do business with essentially the Liberal Party in Canberra? And South Australia needs a strong leader that's prepared to stand up for South Australia. I've always done that, whether it's the river, whether it's subs, whether it's actually fighting for extra jobs once Holden is gone, whether it's fighting off the federal cuts in health and education. We were a lone voice in that Hockey Abbott budget. We're a lone voice. We've been joined by other Labor governments around the nation, but we've continued the fight to ensure that we have proper funding for our basic services.
What's Labor doing with its preferences in this election?
Well, we're preferencing in terms of Nick Xenophon in the seat that he's running in, 50-50, so a split ticket. And then the remainder of the seats, we're giving half the preferences to the Liberal Party and half the preferences to Xenophon. So we couldn't be fairer than that. They're both Liberals from our perspective, so we're splitting it down the middle.
And if Xenophon got the balance of power and was determining the government, would you deal with him?
Of course, but our objective is to get to a majority of seats. But we've demonstrated that we've been able to work in complicated parliaments to form majorities and deliver stable government. But of course, our preference is to be elected in our own right, but we'll only reach principled agreements to remain in government. We're not going to sacrifice our basic values.
And just finally, if you win this election, will you commit to serving out the full four-year term as Premier?
Of course.
Premier, thank you very much for talking with us today. Nick Xenophon, recent polling has shown your SA Best party losing some significant support. It was north of 30%. It's now in the 20s. Do you think the original vote was inflated in the polling, or do you expect that whatever fall has been is now stabilised?
Michelle, I don't know. There has been a relentlessly negative campaign by the major parties. The Liberals say that I'm in bed with Labor. Labor says I'm in bed with the Liberals. You've got the poker machine lobby running a relentless campaign against me. I expect that more than $1 million has been spent against me and SA Best. So obviously that will take the shine off some of those poll figures, which I thought were overly optimistic. But at the last federal election, SA Best polled about 22% of the statewide vote. We're still on about that, and we still managed to pick up the seat of Mayo, which encompasses about four state seats, and came very close in the seat of Grey and in the seat of Barker.
Now, obviously, you don't know, you can't be precise, but what is your general expectation in terms of the number of seats you'll win? You're running 36 candidates?
It's not so much a question of expectation. This is completely uncharted waters. Mm. When Professor Dean Jench, Emeritus Professor Jench, who has been covering elections for over 55 years, when he says that he has no idea what the outcome will be of this election campaign.
Yes, we've talked to him and he said just that.
Did he? Well, I think he is. I'm not going to second guess Professor Jentsch. Anyone who says that they know what the result of the election will be is either a fool or a liar.
Now, if you won the balance of power, would you be willing to negotiate with either side and into some sort of alliance with the side who'd give you most in terms of your program?
There are a whole range of factors to take into account. I don't want to sound like a Reserve Bank governor where we have to be obtuse. I mean, the fact is, it would be arrogant for me to say what we will do until the people decide. But I acknowledge that 16 years is a very long time for any government of any political persuasion. I also am acutely aware of the government's failings in respect of Oakden, and this is the aged care facility for
elder
vulnerable...
abuse,
well, it was... to say elder abuse doesn't really set out the full horrors of what occurred there. The fact that the Independent Commissioner Against Corruption, Bruce Lander, said that this was a shameful chapter in South Australia's history, it says it all. So there are some real issues, and I think that Premier Wetherill has some very serious problems in terms of his credibility. On the other hand, you have the opposition leader, Stephen Marshall, who's taken this quite arrogant view to say that unless he gets a majority of seats, he'll resign as leader. So I think you need to ask the major parties what their plans are. SA Best is fighting hard to break the duopoly. The fact that the major parties are very happy to receive donations from the poker machine lobby and to acquiesce, in a sense, to a very misleading and nasty campaign from the AHA, the hotels lobby, indicates that it will be meet the new boss, same as the old boss in some respects when it comes to gambling reform.
But people wanting to vote for you or thinking they might vote for you are surely entitled to have some idea of which side you would prefer.
Well, this is not a question. I don't prefer either side. I'm sick of both of them. This is a case where we have a government that deserves to lose and an opposition that does not deserve to win. We are the
But post-election, that becomes an irrelevant matter.
Well, Michelle, unless you know what the election result will be, unless you have some greater knowledge than someone like Dean Jentsch, it is simply too early to say.
If then you were negotiating with whichever side, would you be looking to a coalition, being in a ministry, or would you be looking simply to giving support on confidence and
supply? If we're talking about a handful of seats, we do not want to be ministers. We want to be a strong watchdog. We want to make sure that the government of the day, whomever that will be held to account and to reform the parliamentary system, because we have a lazy parliament in South Australia that doesn't do its job.
Now, do you think you're taking more votes from the Liberals or from Labor?
It depends. It depends on the seats. I think that you'll find that in those Labor seats, those strong Labor seats, we're taking more votes off Labor because people are sick of the Labor Party and in terms of the many failings. But in Liberal seats, we're clearly taking more votes off the Liberals because they feel that they have been an ineffective opposition.
And you're running open tickets in every electorate in terms of preferences?
Essentially, that's what the plan has been, and the lodge tickets show a split ticket. That's a safeguard mechanism in the Electoral Act.
Now, you're essentially appealing as a protest party of the centre, but is this surfing on people's discontents primarily, or do you have any sort of really coherent philosophical base across issues?
Michelle, you're so dismissive. We're not a protest party. We're much more than that. We are a party of the political centre where we're about solving problems, not from an ideological perspective, but from looking at the evidence, having better systems of governance in place, strengthening our systems of governance in this state, to have strong whistleblower protection laws so that people can come forward if there's been evidence of waste, corruption, maladministration in the public sector, so all those decent public servants can be empowered to speak out. We're about strengthening the powers of the Auditor General to make sure money is spent well and properly and we get good outcomes. Strengthening the power of the coroner so that unexplained deaths in our hospital system can be thoroughly investigated and acted upon by the Parliament. All those things make a real difference in the way our state will be governed.
Your early career, of course, was built almost entirely on your anti-pokies. approach. And yet in this campaign, you've compromised quite significantly. Indeed, you've been put in the shade by the Tasmanian Labor Party, for example, which had a much tougher anti-pokies policy. Isn't this selling out your own principles and your most loyal original supporters?
Not at all, because this is the dilemma. If you give me a choice, what would I prefer? I'd prefer to see no poker machines, but I'm now part of a party of 41 candidates in all running together. The consensus is this is the best, most practical way to achieve reform, reducing the number of poker machines in hotels by 50% over a five-year period, having $1 bets within the next 12 months and reducing the jackpot so that you reduce the harm significantly. That was a key recommendation of the Productivity Commission. And whilst the Greens have this purist policy of saying getting rid of hotels from pubs and clubs, mirroring the Tasmanian Labor Party stance, it's interesting that the Hotels Association, the Pokies Barons, aren't attacking the Greens, they're attacking me, because they know that's where the threat is in terms of a
bigger
credible
fish,
threat.
I think.
Well, it's because, but it's also because we are offering a sensible transition pathway, and the Tasmanian gambling industry is very different in structure with just one owner of poker machine licenses, Federal Hotels, compared to the South Australian model. So we've taken that into account as well.
Now, what about the campaign in your own seat of Hartley, or the seat you're seeking to win? If you don't win that seat, which is a pretty hotly contested area, and yet some other candidates do get into the parliament, will you still try and lead the party?
Well, firstly, it's not over till it's over. Till 6 p.m. on the 17th of March, when the booths close, when the polling places close. I'll cross that bridge if I get to it. I'm running to win. It's going to be tough. Whatever the outcome, I will be an advocate for my community and for the state. People, if the major parties think that the way that they've done their deals are preferencing effectively each other, particularly the Liberal Party going to Labor ahead of me, the Greens, despite SA Best's environmental record and our rating by the Conservation Council much higher than Labor, and the Liberals, they're preferencing the Liberals ahead of me. They've been a disgrace on that. I'm up against some serious headwinds, but whatever happens, people won't be getting rid of me that easily.
And finally, just in terms of the Senate, you've left the Nick Xenophon team there rather ragged. One of your senators had to resign over her dual citizenship, and her replacement, Tim Storer, is not a member of your party because of a falling out. Are you trying to get him back?
Tim is unambiguously a good bloke. He knows that our doors are open. He knows that he'll be very welcome. Whatever he decides to do, he knows that we will bend over backwards. My colleagues in the Federal Parliament, Rebecca Sharkey in the lower house, Sterling Griffin, Rex Patrick in the Senate, will do everything possible to assist him, whether he is a member of the party or not.
Have you had any talks with him, though, to try
and
persuade
him? No, I haven't,
him?
But the doors are open. That's for Tim. Tim is a terrific bloke, and I think his philosophy is centrist. He wouldn't have run for us unless it was, and I wish him well. And ragged's a bit unkind, and the name of the party is changing to SA Best Federal. That was the plan.
Nick Xenophon, thank you for talking with us today.
Maybe for the last time. Who knows, Michelle?
Oh, I'm sure it won't be for the last time, whatever happens in the election.
Thank you, Michelle.
Christopher Pyne, in the last election, Labor's superior campaigning skill in marginal seats was considered a big factor in costing the Liberals victory. Do you think the Liberals are performing better this time in the marginals?
There's no doubt that the current campaign being run by the South Australian Liberal Party is the best that they've ever run at a state election. It's much more sophisticated, using much more modern technologies, in fact, most modern in Australia, borrowing from the Trump campaign in Ohio, the national campaign in New Zealand most recently, and we've invested in that over the last 4 years. So we learned a lot of lessons from the last election. One of those was you can't fatten the pig on market day. Leader Stephen Marshall.
It's an old election.
It is an oldie, but a goodie. It is an oldie, but a goodie. Stephen Marshall had been the leader for about 8 months. He'd only been in Parliament for less than one term. I think 5 years later after he became leader, so 4 years since the last election, he has improved or learnt a great deal over that period of time and is putting that into place. And so far, touch wood, the campaign is very smooth. He is very sure-footed, and in the marginal seats, that is where our effort is being maintained. In some ways, the Labor Party helped us by insisting on election caps in each seat and a cap overall, because the tendency in the past in the Liberal Party had been to spread our effort thinly. People in safe Liberal seats would say, oh, we have to put in a good campaign, despite the fact they might have a 15 to 25% margin. And resources would be wasted. Our candidates in Labor seats would be working tirelessly to win and insisting on soaking up resources in safe Labor seats. We now have a very good reason why that shouldn't be the case, and the party has got on board in that attitude. So the headquarters is running better than ever before. The leader's office and the headquarters are working together better than ever before. The fundraising has been second to none. Policy development has been better than any campaign in living memory. Stephen Marshall started the campaign with about 130 policies finished and ready to be announced. Every day he's been sticking to his campaign plan. Labor, by contrast, looks desperate and tired. They've had to deal with the Oakden disaster in the middle of the campaign, and Nick Xenophon clearly hasn't got any policies, and the ones that he has announced have blown up in his face like the old exploding cigar.
You mentioned that some lessons had come from the Trump campaign. Just briefly, can you give us an illustration of that?
Well, the use of targeting voters and collecting as much information as possible over a long period of time about what voters are interested in. I mean, what we used to send out electorate-wide letters. We spent a lot of work on those letters to get the 3 or 4 or 5 points that were needed to convey to the voter, and then we'd hit every household with exactly the same letter. I think in one election many years ago, I sent out something like 11 direct mail letters across the electorate when it was cheaper, I might add. That just doesn't happen anymore. Now, the data that's collected that the Trump campaign successfully used to target the states and even the counties where they needed to focus, we are focusing our effort on collecting as much information as possible so that we tell the voter in particular what it is that they want to talk about. So it might be a local roads issue. It might be power prices. It might be investments in women's change rooms in the local football club because of the emergence of WAFL, Women's AFL, Michelle, in case you're not sure. But we are targeting that message through mobile phones, through emails, through technology, through social media. We will probably spend a lot more, I think, on social media advertising than we will on television advertising in this campaign, because that's the very nature of the change that we're undergoing. And that was first, I think, obvious in the Clinton versus Trump campaign a year or so ago.
Is it your impression that SA Best is taking more votes from the Liberals than it's taking from Labor?
Well, my impression is that the Labor vote has tanked in South Australia, that they are very much struggling to get their own base back. Hence, they are spending money on infrastructure in seats like Elizabeth, where they've never spent money before. Announcing a 75% renewable energy target was designed to get back far-left voters. That's not a policy that appeals to the more centrist voter. That the Xenophon campaign has been the recipient of a lot of the Labor vote leaving the Labor Party, and the Liberal vote has held up pretty well. That once the arrival of Xenophon came on the scene, we had a dip, but our vote has recovered pretty well, whereas Labor's is still in recovery mode. And whether they recover enough by election day is a $64 question, but that Nick Xenophon has failed to meet expectations.
What are the Liberals doing with preferences in regard to Xenophon?
We're running a, I think, put Labor last campaign across the state. So Labor is last in every seat. I think in some particular seats, we have a split ticket, but we're not preferencing Labor exclusively over Xenophon in any seat. And I think Labor has a very similar approach. So it's generally letting voters make their own decisions about preferences, but we are putting Labor last in most of the lower house seats. Of course, it's very likely that the Liberal Party's preferences won't be distributed. In almost every seat, we'll come either first or second on primaries. It'll only be a handful of seats that our preferences will even be distributed.
Now, the federal government has obviously put a lot of funds into South Australia for the coming years, especially in your area of defence industry, the submarine project, other shipbuilding. Are you finding that this is helping your Liberal colleagues at the state level?
Nobody in South Australia that I've spoken to believes that the Labor government had anything to do with delivering the submarine project to the state. I know that's one of their claims, but the submarine project and the Future Frigates project, the enormous infrastructure investment at Osborne South and North, which is $1.2 billion, the defence industry build-up itself is very much associated with the federal government. And I just don't think it's been a factor in supporting Labor or Liberal. It certainly probably helped the Liberal brand across South Australia. And when Labor has tried to pretend that the federal government isn't investing in South Australia, it's been mostly met by a horse laugh from a lot of people because they think, well, it's the biggest infrastructure investment in the Commonwealth government's history is the shipbuilding, submarine building and infrastructure at Osborne. It's a $90 billion investment. So it's very hard for Labor to pretend that we're not investing in South Australia.
Are you finding that current federal issues, the Joyce affair and other things, are having any impact in this campaign, or are people completely focused on the state level?
Well, I've been door knocking, supermarketing, telephone canvassing, fundraising for several weeks and months over the longer term. Not one person has raised the issues in Canberra with me. It's very much jobs, economy, health, education services, kids leaving South Australia for better horizons elsewhere kind of campaign. And of course, power prices is number one issue raised by everyone. Issues like Oakden and mental health and child protection. Nobody has raised a federal issue with me for many weeks in terms of the state campaign.
So will the result have any federal implications, a Liberal win, a Liberal loss?
Well, I think when we win the election, and I believe we will, that it will confirm a couple of things. That the idea that the coalition is a busted flush is not borne out by reality. New England, Bennelong, Tasmania, if we win in South Australia, which I think we will, I think the commentators who constantly write off the coalition will have to again rethink their position. And secondly, it'll prove that the polling, modern polling, is really taking a battering in terms of its importance and usefulness. I was shocked in the Bennelong by-election that News Poll was 50% out. They said we were going to have a 10% swing against us. It was 4.8. The polls over the last few months, the statewide polls, have given, I think, a very skewed view of what's happening in the state. But if you actually look at the seat-by-seat polling that even the Advertiser is doing, let alone other people like the Liberal Party itself, these statewide polls are pretty meaningless, especially in a three-horse race. So I think if we win the election and people express amazing surprise at this in 10 days, it won't be a surprise to people who've actually been following it more closely. And I think it'll make people rewrite their view of polling in particular and just how useful this statewide or nationwide polling is.
We have found many people, a bit reluctant to predict this election, but you're bravely out there. We'll see what happens in 10 days.
We'll know in 10 days.
Christopher Pyne, thank you very much for talking with us. Finally, in this podcast, we turn to Professor Carol Johnson from the University of Adelaide to sum up the election for us. Professor Johnson, something over a week out from polling day, how do you see this campaign is playing out?
Well, it's still very uncertain exactly what the result is going to be. The parties have solidified their positions and have attempted to get their messages across. Possibly Labor's message is actually clearer than the Liberals at this stage. The Liberals actually have a very large number of policies, and sometimes what is meant to be their really clear message of more jobs, better services and lower costs isn't necessarily cutting through quite as much as you'd expect it to. And some of the gloss has worn off the Xenophon factor. But it's still an election where one really can't be sure of what the results or outcome will be. It's still very uncertain.
We'll come back to the Xenophon factor, but of the two major party leaders, who's performed best?
In many respects, I think Jay Weatherill is actually performing best, which is surprising given the number of problems that his government has had in recent years and the various scandals. Stephen Marshall still doesn't seem to be giving quite as an assured performance as one would expect.
One of the problems, obviously, that the government had that looked to be looming really, really large is the issue of energy security and power prices. And yet that seems to have faded slightly. Is that right? Or is it really there in voters' minds?
It does seem to have faded slightly. And in its example of how one should never underestimate Jay Weatherill. He's snatched victory from the jaws of defeat previously, and who knows, it's possible he could do so again. Basically, what he's managed to do is he's been a political fixer. He's seen this as a major issue for his government, as something that was undermining their record. He's done his best to fix it, and he's actually tried to turn it into a positive. And one of the ways in which he's done this is through his association with Elon Musk. With the world's largest lithium-ion battery, we've now basically suggesting that they're going to establish a virtual power plant. He's tried to suggest that actually what Labor's going to be putting forward is plans for the industries of the future, and to associate himself with a really iconic entrepreneurial figure on the world stage, such as Elon Musk.
That battery is a bit of a gee whiz sort of factor in the election, perhaps.
It is a gee whiz factor. And now also he suggested the virtual power plant and basically assisting large numbers of South Australians to actually have Tesla batteries and to set up this virtual power plant. So he's tried to suggest that actually the Labor government is being particularly innovative and cutting edge, which for a government that's been in power for 16 years is an important thing to do. He's trying to make the government seem fresh when, of course, to many observers at the start of the campaign, it seemed that this was a government past its use-by date, in serious trouble with various scandals it had been dealing with and various problems such as the power supply problems.
Now, what about the X factor in this election?
Well, once again, another politician who can never be underestimated is Nick Xenophon. He is a very capable politician, as we've seen at both state and federal level. Some of the gloss is wearing off, however. There have been policy gaffes, and one of the problems he always would have is whether SA Best had the policy depth to be able to address what are the very real substantial problems that the South Australian economy is going to be facing. And some of that lack of policy depth has shone through on occasion. On the other hand, he's attracted some very good candidates, many of whom are politically inexperienced, but they have high profiles in their community. So he certainly could still be a significant factor in the campaign. A lot, of course, will depend on how preferences are distributed, but he could still end up being the kingmaker.
So his candidates, you think, on the whole, have been a positive, not a negative, as we saw, for example, with some Hanson candidates in other state elections?
Well, at the start, SA Best made some very basic mistakes with its candidates, like not actually checking out their Facebook sites or various other politics 101 errors that you wouldn't have expected a party that in one form or another had actually been around for a while, even if not specifically as SA Best to do. But once he started picking up in the polls, he started attracting a higher quality of candidate and candidates that potentially could pose a problem for Labor, not just the Liberals. I mean, Xenophon's major challenge and major problem will be for the Liberals, and Stephen Marshall must have been extremely disturbed when he heard that Nick Xenophon was moving back to focus on South Australia, because Marshall must have thought, given everything that had gone wrong with the Weatherill government, given the problems such as Oakden, given the problems over power, that actually he had a very good chance of finally winning this election. And the X factor is the wild card in this election that's made everything a lot less certain and very, very hard to predict.
Just finally, are the federal factors in the campaign and federal implications in the result?
I suspect that federal factors per se are not going to play a major role, but they are going to be significant in an indirect way. One of them is that Jay Weatherill is constantly arguing that he is standing up for South Australia, and the implication is that the coalition government federally can't be trusted to look after things like South Australia's water supply. Some of the attacks over power security by the Turnbull government were actually interpreted by some South Australians as being an eastern state style attack on South Australia per se, so didn't necessarily work as the federal government expected. So there is that factor that Jay Weberall is arguing that he's going to stand up for South Australia against a federal coalition government, which he's suggesting Stephen Marshall can't be trusted to do because they're from the same party. The other factor is that in order for Stephen Marshall to appear to be the leader of an effective, competent alternative government, it would have been helpful for him if the federal coalition government was actually seeming to be effective and in good shape. The fact that it is currently not effective and in good shape is potentially undermining his ability to project the Liberals as an alternative, effective state government.
And federal implications?
Federally, I think it will be very embarrassing for the federal coalition if the Liberals lose this election. This really is an election that the Liberals should have won and that normally one would expect them to win. Labor's been in office, often hanging on very tenuously in South Australia since 2002. There have been various issues that have occurred. There are fundamental problems of the state economy, as of course there are for economies in many other parts of Australia and indeed the world internationally at present. One would have reasonably expected that this could have been an election that the Liberals would win. So if they don't, it could potentially be seen as reflecting on the federal coalition. And of course, we know that there are issues that have been raised about whether the coalition is adequately supporting jobs in South Australia, whether the federal coalition is adequately supporting water supplies, that also have implications.
Carol Johnson, thank you very much for your observations. And that's all from our podcast in South Australia. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. Next week, we'll be in the Victorian federal seat of Batman, where the Greens and Labor are fighting it out in a very interesting by-election. March 17 could be quite an exciting night all round. Goodbye for now.